During April, The Guardian's podcasts are partnering with audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/audible to find out more.
Hello, this is Music Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alexis Petridis.
And I'm Kieran Yates. Coming up, we'll be hearing about the Mad Men and Mavericks who have made independent music, courtesy of author Richard King, and auditioning three new releases in Singles Club.
Plus, Kieran has been talking to Rudimental. Joining us this week, I think for the first time, Laura Barton.
First time in a while.
In a long time. Wow. Mm. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Yes.
Excellent. Splendid. What are the big news stories of the week, apart from the Smiths not reforming? Should the Smiths have reformed? Kieran.
Yeah, I mean, as a massive fan of the Smiths, I mean, I followed all their early work and I know all their names. And yes, it's a yes from
me. It's a big yes from you. Yep. Laura, would you have been... I assume you may have been... fan of the Smiths.
Indeed, yes.
Would you have been disappointed had they reformed?
No. I mean, I would have pretended to for probably about a week.
But you'd have been really
into
excited.
It.
Would
you? I mean, it would be amazing, wouldn't it? Let's be honest. You're actually there. It wouldn't be... You wouldn't have that question mark over it like you have with, say, Stone Roses or something. They would be brilliant.
They would be good. Yeah, I suppose they would be good. Mm. But, you know... I think there's something nice about a band actually not reforming. I think this is the positive side of Morrissey's terrible character.
Yeah. It's much classier. I mean, I feel the same about the White Stripes. I really hope they never.
Yeah, I doubt they'll ever.
No.
Did you go and see anyone going to see Jack White this week?
I was supposed to be in the night stadium.
I heard it was quite bad though. Lots of.
Oh, I heard mixed reports. Dorian liked it.
Oh, did he?
Tell you what, I was surprised there wasn't more comment about. Saw some photos of the gig.
Right.
Jack White, big lad.
He
dresses to the left.
Yep.
He is, as my mother would have said, a boy with a big personality.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Yeah, there you go. No, I was just surprised there wasn't more remark about this because of these.
I think it's been remarked upon in the past.
Has it?
Yeah.
You could see his penis through his trousers. Anyway, but more rock stars should do that. The rock stars in the '70s do that all the time. Anyway, Kieran, you've been talking to Rudimental.
I have, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Rudimental. Tell us about.
So they are a four-piece production outfit from East London. They've kind of been doing lots of production over the past few years, kind of doing individually garage stuff. One of the guys was kind of voted on the NME Producers of the Year, Best Producers of the Year or something a few years ago. And they've kind of just come together after releasing a really big track called Spoons. But it's been really, really well received. And they've been on Rinse and they've been on Radio 1 and they've kind of been everywhere. And now they just released their new single called Feel the Love, which is a little bit more drum and bass influenced.
And this is the first interview they've ever done.
It is, yes.
Ever.
You might be able to tell.
Let's have a listen.
I'm Kezzy, one part of Rudimental, there's four of us.
I'm Amir.
I'm Piers. Yeah, Leon can't make it today, so unfortunately.
It's all right, we've got the talent here. Right?
Yeah,
here in spirit.
So, tell me a little bit about how you're dealing with your fame at the moment. Because you've had a really good reception, haven't you, so far? I mean, you were Zane Lowe's hottest track of the year or the week?
It's been going really well. We've kind of been making music for about 4 or 5 years now. It's been putting songs out. We're with a label called Black Butter Records, and we put some songs out last year, and you know had a bit of success, but obviously nothing like the last couple of weeks. So it's been really good, man. And obviously we had the Spoons release, which kind of helped a lot. So
yeah, I guess Spoons was the first track that really got us into the limelight.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about that track because I think. One of the things that's really interesting about it is the, well, percussion-wise, I think you used real spoons, didn't you?
That was Amir's
idea. And you've got some kind of great vocalists, Siron and MNEK, obviously. Yeah. How did that come about and how did that come to be?
Well, MNEK, we're based in a studio in East London, in Shoreditch, and MNEK is actually there too. He's using one of the rooms. And he was literally coming around to see how we're doing, to say hello. And
he's
we were working on this beat. He's a mate, and he was coming around to see what we were up to, and we were just working on this beat. And yeah, I just picked up some cutlery because we were looking for some hi-hats and we couldn't find any good sounds, so just played some spoons on it. I must have been eating some jerk chicken or something. And then MNEK came around and he basically wrote half the song in a few minutes, and he just started humming it. So we just put him down on the mic, and then later on, was it the next day Daisy came down?
Daisy came Siren. next day, it kind of evolved into a duet, didn't it?
Cause, yeah.
And
the whole track took 2 days to make, yeah. Really, including mixing and doing all the boring stuff, yeah. As well.
What I think is really interesting about that is that when it was released into the blogosphere, there was so much written about, you know, this kind of two-step revival or this, you know, these garage sounds. And then that was a really interesting point about, you know, a lot of people doing kind of garage influenced music, yeah. And then you sort of followed that up with very kind of drum and bass, you know, very hard drum and bass tracks. So how do you make that transition?
I think the thing is, like, what has got us all the attention is the songs, because we write the lyrics and we write vocals as well,
yeah.
So we're not just making beats and then getting people in to top line them and things, yeah. Like that. So the boy, I think that's been our selling point, yeah. Is the song, is the soulfulness of the music.
We're products of producers in London. When you grow up in London, you know, when I was like 16, 17, I was really into Dizzy Rascal, but I was also really into like blues and people like Skip James, and just like, you know, yeah. Really, really interesting blues artists. That's partly because obviously, you know, my dad's a musician, studying music in school, you know, just like what you come across. So,
yeah. See, I think that's a common factor between all of us, like, all of us have been in this kind of melting pot, and it sounds kind of cheesy, but
yeah.
More so in our group than anyone else, that kind of, you know, Piers has been into the blues and the hip-hop, and I was into soul, and Kezzy's into, you know, soul and jazz and hip-hop and a bit of everything, and it kind of came together like that, you know, equally into soul and hip-hop. So it weren't like,
so you don't have fights in the studio about he wants more two-step and he wants more hip-hop?
No,
he wants drum and bass.
So we definitely have, like, arguments.
Yeah,
but
we don't have fights, but we have our opinions. And sometimes they differ, but generally we're all on the same page. But sometimes there's certain bits that I will love, for example, and someone will be like, no, I really don't like that. And we sort of try and meet halfway sometimes. So
all great boy bands need a bit of tension, guys.
Yeah.
We need to work on those dance moves. Yeah. In a boy band, it's ain't going to happen.
Tell me a little bit about drum and bass, because I think that's been a little bit more of a consistent sound with Feel the Love, and with the Ed Sheeran remix. Were you fans? Were you kind of fans of Andy C and Algebra?
Well, when I grew up, even sort of like early sort of 12, 13, my dad was a heavy jungle fan, and Cool FM was actually round the corner from me in Hackney. And yeah, just I'm more jungle is I think my big thing, old school jungle thing. Yeah, really,
old school jungle is more of an influence on us. Although we do love drum and bass in its kind of new form.
In terms of club culture, how do drum and bass raves compare to jungle raves? Or were you too young to go to jungle raves?
I was too young. I was definitely
too young.
But yeah,
garage raves are good.
Yeah, garage raves we managed to catch, but Rudimental as a group, you definitely find us more on the kind of soulful, less packed kind of club environment. If we do go clubbing, because I think, you know,
the only time we go clubbing now is when we're DJing, really.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know.
But I think we definitely like a bit of space when we dance, rather than just
especially
rubbing
Piers
up against
arms flailing and kicking.
Piers has got a dancing related injury in one of his knees, actually.
Yeah.
I have to say.
Yeah, I
would you like to tell him more about this?
I tore a few ligaments in my knee having a James Brown dance off with someone else. I think that we're just going to leave it there. It was a very traumatic time.
It's a serious injury.
It was caught
on camera.
Yeah,
it's caught on camera.
And we need to make sure.
And where can we find this video, guys?
I think we need to delete it.
I think we should put it on YouTube.
Because they're going to upload it onto YouTube at some point. Yeah.
Okay, tell me a little bit about Feel the Love, which is your next release, which has got an amazing video, which has been causing lots of excitement on the blogs and with people writing about it.
Well, the song sort of first came about a little while ago. I used to work in a school as a learning mentor, and it was literally last day of term. And I remember sort of going home just in a good vibe. Anyone that works in the school will know on your last day, you're just bubbling sort of thing. So rather than go to the pub and get drunk with half the teachers as they do, I happened to go home and just threw down some chords, sang a couple melodies, and sort of got the core of the track together, and then took it down to the studio. I met up with the rest of the guys, and everyone was like, wow, what's this sort of thing? Yeah. And he's just...
That's how it first initially started.
A bit crazy in the studio.
When Kezi first brought it, it was like, you know, the first time we heard it, we were just like, oh, my God, what is this? And we just started dancing on chairs. Leon, who's not here, started taking his top off. But, I mean, there's actually a video of that. But we don't know when that's going to surface.
You didn't bring the one guy that might take his top off. Thanks, guys.
It's a common occurrence with Leon, to be honest.
He's quite
charismatic. That's how we know if a song is good. If his top's still on, it's not good.
And obviously, from then on, it was just like, right, how can we... What can we do to this? And obviously we brought in...
I suppose I came along at that point and we kind of put the production on it and sort of made it into more of a... Put the programming on there, did the drums and put the instruments on there.
Trumpet player. One of my mates, Mark Crown, who's a really good trumpeter. Yeah. He's the guy that solos.
Rudimental family.
He's the guy that solos on the song. We got him down.
Live bass on there and stuff, so we just kind of
built it up.
I was
going to say, you can really you can hear those kind of brass inflections, and you can hear that real instrumentation kind of underlying. It's not even kind of very subtle samples. It's very in your face. And
I mean, that's down to the fact that we're all actually musicians. We're not really sort of from the bedroom producer background. In a way, we are. We're from both backgrounds.
Right?
It goes
both,
back
really.
To that thing
of
coming from the live and from the program music background. So we kind of combine those two.
I mean, at the moment, our live thing is just a DJ set, but in the up and coming months, you want to sort of play live as a band. So that is the plan.
Our ultimate goal is you know, big stage, full brass, you know, backing singers, you know, a real good musical show with
Will there be the horses from the Feel the Love video?
I'd love to. We go down to Lee Valley, get some horses, see if they'll be up for it. I don't know.
The Feel the Love video was great,
man. His training.
We really enjoyed that. We shot it in Philadelphia, which was amazing.
Fletcher Street.
Yeah. Stables.
We went out there, and it's the community in Fletcher Street. They race horses on the weekend. You know, they all own their own. Some of them own their own horse, and it's like a real. It's a good community of horse riders.
Really. Yes, it's like their lifestyle. I mean, like, you got kids in England. We all have our bicycle and ride down the street to meet our friend. They'll go and pick up their horse and ride up to the basketball court, tie their horse up and play basketball. It's like, we never knew something like that existed. And so it's an amazing thing to see.
When we
saw the treatment for the video and what they wanted to do, is like, that sounds perfect. And
I mean, we played them the song, and a few of them were loving it. And it was definitely, it was quite interesting to see a reaction, because obviously they hadn't heard John Bass before.
Very fast for them, I think.
But they did love it. They loved the melody and the vocal.
But you were saying, Kezi, that your background is very much hip-hop based. So how do you feel about really speeding those tempos up now and doing more drum and bass?
I think it's like a natural progression in a way. I think we don't try and think too much about what we're doing. We just go with the vibe. And if it sounds right and if it feels right, we try and get it out in our music, really. A lot of hip-hop is sort of samples of different genres of music that you can see in our productions. So... thinks it's just kind of naturally come along, really.
There's definitely a lot of soul in hip-hop.
Yeah,
I think that's
big time.
Something that's always been in hip-hop. So
when we were in a club where we definitely would like to hear more melodic and soulful stuff, so I think that comes out naturally in our productions. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say something as cheesy as bringing the soul back to electronic music, but
we're bringing the soul back to electronic music.
The single, Feel the Love, is out on May 27th, and that's Rudimental, who are currently finishing an album that will come out on Black Butter Records and Asylum. Let's bring on the Mighty Singles Club. Let's start with Laura's Choice.
I wish there was another way of getting down to
Party on. That's Dawn. Is it pronounced Dawn?
I have no idea. Dohan? But I'm going to say Dohan.
We'll go with Dawn. D-A-U-G-H-N, Gibson, and A Young Girl's World. I know nothing about... I don't know how to pronounce his name. tell me all about, or tell us, tell the world all about Dawn Gibson.
I don't know super loads about him, but he is from Pennsylvania, and I know that he wants to sort of rekindle country music with sort of... samples and more sort of sonic experimentation.
Interesting.
Yes. People keep referring to him as being something like the James Blake of country.
Wow.
I don't know if that's true, but I do like his album. I've been listening to it for a little while now, and it puts me in mind a little bit of Willis L. Beale and some of the stuff he's doing, that sort of slightly unsettling quality. Mm-hmm. But what I love about this is it has that nice mixture of old and new. It feels a bit Jimmy Webb, a bit MacArthur Park, a bit Scott Walker, you know, all that kind of
stuff. He sounds a bit like Jim Morrison,
I thought. Yes, yep. And a bit Johnny Cash and some of the other tracks. So. Okay.
Has he been sort of accepted by the Nashville mainstream? Because lots of people do interesting things with country music, but the sort of mainstream of Nashville tends to, you know, eschew those people.
I would be very surprised if they even know he exists. They're too busy snorting rhinestones.
Is his album out?
It is out, yes. It is available to download.
Wonderful. Karen?
I thought it was interesting. I thought what was really, really beautiful is that kind of piano line at the beginning, you know, when it comes in and it's just really beautiful with this kind of ghostly melancholia. It's, you know, it's really lovely. And then his voice comes in and it's almost terrifying, kind of deep, kind of, you know, bellowing voice, which I think is a little bit unsettling, but I can see what you would like about that. And it's quite interesting that you talk about him being described as the James Blake of country, because I think Paul Lester said something like, imagine someone at Forward wearing a cowboy hat or something, which I thought was really, really weird.
What would happen if you went to Forward wearing a cowboy hat?
Everyone's welcome. I thought that was quite pretty. I thought it was really different to, I can't remember the other song that I heard from him, but it was completely different. This was a kind of this slow, more restrained type.
What's his up-tempo stuff like? That's an interesting point.
It's quite, and this may be my criticism of the album, is that he seems to be trying a lot of shoes with every little hats with whichever item of clothing you
cowboy
want to say.
Hats, cowboy boots.
With every song. And I would have liked a little more continuity throughout it. But sometimes he does sound very Johnny Cash, and sometimes he sounds more metally at times, or more rocky.
Yeah, really? I thought that. It's more kind of this crashing sound of kind of metally, rock type stuff. And I was like, oh. So when I heard this, I was like, oh, this is a little bit gentler.
Yeah.
So that's Dawn, or Dohan Gibson, with A Young Girl's World. What's his album called?
I cannot remember, so sorry, that's really rubbish for me.
From his mysterious...
It's clearly not Dohan, is it? Like, every time you say that.
I really want it to be Dohan.
I don't think it's
Dohan. It sounds more American. Dohan! Like, come here, Dohan!
It's like Dawn.
Dawn. Yeah, that's how I picture it.
Dawn, okay, Dawn Gibson, A Young Girl's World. The album is out, available to download, probably on Spotify, I would imagine. It's on iTunes, wonderful, wonderful. Anyway, right, Kieran, let's hear your choice. That's Quez with it's Dohan all over again. What is it? Egoya?
No, it's like LGOYH, which stands for Let Go of Your Hurt.
Let Go of Your Hurt. Well, let's just call it Let Go of Your Hurt.
Yeah.
From a forthcoming EP on Warp Records. I like that a lot, and it reminded me a bit of Gorillaz, actually. He sounded a little bit Damon Albarn-esque, had that sort of kaleidoscopic thing going on. And I was surprised because I was under the impression, incorrectly, that Quez was like a rapper. So I was quite taken aback. I don't know why I got the idea he's a rapper.
No.
False information. Tell me about Quez. Tell us about Quez.
Quez, also known as Quezzy So, is a singer, songwriter, producer from where else but South London, where all the talent is from. And he...
Tell that to Dohan Gibson.
And so this is from the Meantime EP, which is out, I think it's at the end of the month on Warp. Yeah, and I really love it. He, kind of a bit of his background is he most recently produced the Speech to Bell album.
Okay.
Freedom of Speech. And then in 2008, he did the Quesachu mixtape, which was Quez and Mikachu. And they did like this collaboration thing. And I'm a big fan of Mikachu as well. So, yeah, that was really, really good. And he's, you know, as a character, he's, you know, very, very kind of techno geeky about, you know, all this kind of stuff. You know, he's been kind of producing and, you know, making music since he was really, really young. And, you know, he's kind of quite a stripped back, restrained, eccentric type character. And I think that it really comes through in this, especially because there's just so much going on. And I think at times it feels quite dense. There's that kind of his vocals and then that guitar feedback and that, you know, really apparent synthy sound. It just feels like, you know, usually I get a little bit overwhelmed by when it's all going on at the same time. But what I quite liked about this was that it's all there, but it seems very considered and it feels very well produced.
I think the sweetness of the melody pulls you through the kind of clatteriness of the backtrack. To the extent that I actually think, you know, in an alternative world where Radio 1 played records that didn't all sound like each other and didn't all sound like they were produced by Calvin Harris, that could actually be a hit. That could be a hit single.
It's quite beautiful, isn't it?
It's a really pretty song. Laura?
I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I like the sort of euphoria of it. And I knew about him from his work with Mikachu, who I really like as well. Mm-hmm. And there's that similar joy in sound. I mean, all the different samples, but just very particularly chosen, not with that sort of bland Calvin Harris, that sound will do. He just seems to absolutely love very particular sound. And that was what half the sweetness came for me as well.
That's brilliant. You think the EP's out at the end of the month?
Yes.
Wonderful. And he's got an album presumably coming after that?
Yeah, well, this is from the Meantime EP, which is going to be out. And then, yeah, I guess he'll follow it up with something, hopefully.
That's great stuff. Quez, the Meantime EP, out at the end of this month. Finally, my choice. I'm not hard as a rock. I'm just not easy to break. But don't take it as an open invitation to try, 'cause I'm just hoping this time that it's all in my mind. I won't find that there's anything to worry about. I want you to be yourself. I love it when I see you having fun. I don't wanna be your shadow, sadness taking away the sun. That's Just a Touch by Aluna George, which is a B-side of a fourth or a track on a forthcoming three-track EP. We had Aluna George on Singles Club before. In fact, Kieran, you brought them in. And I think it's fair to say, I don't think I've ever liked a track that's been on Singles Club as much as I like that Aluna George track. I was sort of thinking basically what I like. What do I like in music? I thought I like really good big tunes and like weird noises. And
do you like disco or something?
I like quite a lot of disco, yeah, psychedelia. And that sort of ties together lots of different things that I like. And this ticks both boxes, and it's got a really good tune, and it's got loads of weird noises. What I like also about it is there's a lot of music around, whether it's indie music, R&B, hip-hop, that seems to have coagulated in one place. And it's this sort of drifty, hazy, sounds like the radio's not tuned in properly, you know, and that's like goes across your dream, whatever you call it. What do you call it again? Dream? What does they call that kind of music? Beach, hazy?
No idea.
You know, bands
just
like...
Just coin a whole new phrase.
Beach house. What are they called? Beach house?
Beach house is a band.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's no name for that kind of music. There is. Come on, people, help me out.
We're just staring at Alexis blankly. Idea. Do you mean that kind of Ibiza style?
No, I mean that kind of like American West Coast American,
like that Vegas kind of,
like that sort of dreamy hipstermatic kind of you know indie music. And it's well, okay. So, and that crosses from sort of indie music into, you know, cloud rap into, you know, areas of R&B. And I think one of the interesting things about Aluna George is they're coming at it from a completely different angle to that. They're making kind of you know, contemporary modern R&B, plus a pop R&B that isn't. It doesn't sound like sort of contemporary modern pop R&B, which all sounds like it's produced by Calvin Harris, nor does it sound like this kind of, what the alternative that seems to be, which is this sort of hazy, you know, whatever kind of sound. It just seems to me to be really, really original.
It almost sounds urban in the truest sense of the word, doesn't it? In that it's quite hard and it's quite frantic and it's very there and it's not this reflective, chill wavy, you know... kind of thing where you're just sitting back and letting it wash over you and reflecting. It's very much like it's there and it can't be ignored. And
absolutely,
it's very representative of the experience of the city.
You're right. It does sound like a record from London, definitely. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was also really glad because I liked the previous Luna George track. You know, you like it so much that I thought, it would be my luck that this is a complete one-off and every other song by them is total pony. And this came out, which is the B-side to a reissue of that track, effectively, coming out. And it's really good. And this is something that stuck out in a B-side. And I just think, wow, you know, given the right push, given the right thing, this is a band that could actually be really successful. Yeah. And that's really nice as well. Laura.
I love it. I love the phrasing. I love everything about it, apart from the chorus. I think it gets a little bit naff there. Mm-hmm. The sounds go a bit too wacky mallet, and it reminds me too much. It reminds me too much of, do you remember Jennifer Page, Crush?
Oh yeah, you're right.
It sounds
it's
exactly
just
like,
a little crush. Yeah. Good tune.
Yeah, I mean, good tune, but it feels a bit too. I hadn't thought about that.
Maybe that's
really
what I like.
Cool
it.
Until the chorus.
Okay,
thought,
that's good.
What I quite like though is that it can be quite difficult to be catchy alongside distorted electronica, kind of. And I think that naffness is also why it's so catchy and why you have gone to it.
I thought though that there are other bits of the song that are just as catchy. Okay. That are in a way, the lead up to the chorus is really catchy, and almost that could be the chorus to me. And then it goes just a little frill too far, but that's just me.
You obviously like it, Kieran.
Yeah, I like it. I saw them live last year, which was part of kind of some of their single launches. And she's like amazing, amazing looking. Anyway, Aluna is just like beautiful girl.
I'm not interested in that sort of thing. I'm all about
and George is kind of, you know, this kind of in the background, you know, craned over his little MPC player, and it worked really, really well because I wasn't sure how that would translate into.
It does seem a very studio based sound.
She sounded really, really good, and it was one of, you know, I think it was one of their first kind of, you know, live performances.
They're playing down at the Great Escape in Brighton on the Thursday, I think, which is the weekend, not next weekend, the weekend after. Just a touch by Luna George. That's coming out. It's already, you can find it on SoundCloud at the moment. It's coming out, I think, next month. But there you go, that's Singles Club for this week. Author Richard King has picked over 30 years of the British indie scene from 1975 to 2005 and put his findings down in a new book called How Soon Is Now. In it, you will find the bloody-minded visionaries behind labels such as Factory, Rough Trade, Mute, 4AD, Beggar's Banquet, Creation and many more. Richard came in to talk to Michael Hann, who began by asking him why the whole idea of the indie label still resonates so strongly.
I think one of the reasons is the omnipresence of the word indie, and it's a word that perhaps we struggle to define these days. It's so prevalent in just about everything. I'm sure there's an indie car wash somewhere. So I just wanted to go back to its original definition coming from independent labels, independent music, and try and approach a definition that encompassed all the excitement and the chaos and the bad business decisions, but also the enthusiasm and the... I just think it's really important there's a space where amateurs could make it up as they go along. And I think that's a good metaphor for independence. And it's a space that's increasingly being closed down. I thought to give it its historical significance, it was important to discuss the people that had managed to intervene or create an intervention in the mainstream. So that is 4AD, Factory, Creation, Rough Trade. And I suppose the whole thing started in terms of the idea of penetrating the mainstream with Alan Horn and Edwin and their idea of Orange Juice having to be a top 10 band which they didn't manage to do on Postcard, but of course Orange Juice managed a few years later.
There's a real sense in your book of people flying by the seat of their pants and managing to create something extraordinary by chance. Do you think chance was a huge factor in all of that?
I think chance was a huge factor, but also the economics were such that you could just throw loads of stuff at a wall and sooner or later something would stick. Much of the sector was financed by Rough Trade Distribution, who basically, if you walked in there with a kind of release schedule on the back of an envelope and they thought you knew what you were doing, they'd offer to not only distribute your records but manufacture them for you. So you had this huge warehouse full of people who were basically tying up all their profit into releasing 1,000 runs of 7-inch singles. And even the kind of smallest labels, regional labels that were a success out of the cartel, you know, getting very, very obscure, Ron Johnson or Vindaloo or those kind of labels, they all managed, you know, a discography of 30 or 40 titles without ever really doing it, even having a kind of indie hit. So there was a mechanism in place and a space was created where people could just have a go, really. And so the lucky ones knew what to do with that kind of luck. I think it's also worth noting that people like Martin Mills got a PPE from Oxford, Jeff Travis went to Cambridge, Anthony Wilson, as I think he probably told everyone he ever met, went to Cambridge. So you had some, you know, well-educated, quite idealistic people. There have always been those kind of people in the music business, but perhaps not quite such a cluster of them in a place that they created for themselves.
It's interesting what you're saying about the role of rough trade distribution. Another thing that clearly comes through from the book is the financial chaos at Rough Trade. I mean, as you've referred to Rough Trade going bankrupt. And this incredibly telling line, I think it's Richard Scott talking about how, of Rough Trade Distribution, talking about how it was a disaster when there were a load of big indie hits because suddenly they were going to have to pay out money to the labels that had made them. And where were they going to get the money from?
Sure. I mean, I think the sector isn't geared up to, it doesn't have the mechanism to have success and to know what to do with success. So if an album had a hit single, you know, often it wasn't the single that was on the album. It was just something floating around that came out. And so there was never any kind of long-term planning of what the third single would be, what the video would be, that kind of thing. So what also tends to happen is you have hits, you have a load of money, you pay off your debtors and you think, oh, we can do all that over again. Before you know it, you've spent all the money and you're in debt again. So, I mean, having said that, I think it's a good qualifier is that since the mid-80s, the period we're talking about, I don't think major labels are that good at having hits either. I mean, I think they're reliant on Queen and the Beatles and Pink Floyd and back catalogue. So I think they've picked up a lot of bad habits from the independent labels as well.
There's a sense of huge personalities in your book, people kind of bending the world to their will. I mean, these were people I remember as a kid. They'd be in the NME almost as often as their bands. Mm. And people like Alan McGee. I remember going to the Creation All Day at the Forum and people walking past Alan McGee and swearing at him. People who'd never met him, but because he was Alan McGee and he's this hugely divisive figure. And yet, characters like that seem to have disappeared from independent music. Why is that? It's just the 80s you needed to be that kind of personality to make a success of running a successful indie label?
Since the early 90s, you know, you don't have the time to kind of experiment with the, or even enjoy the idea of being someone who runs a record company anymore. You know, people like Alan or Tony Wilson were very popular in America with major label executives because they could fly in, both overemphasize their regional accents and generally be, you know, were given license to become these sort of eccentric figures. And you know, people like Seymour Stein and some of the people on the West Coast with Warner Brothers, really, and Mo Austin and these people who wanted to sign New Order, they really, really define that kind of maverick spirit in American music. And I think people like McGee and Wilson, even slightly more taciturn people like Jeff Travis and Ivo, learnt a lot from those kind of people and learnt to be bloody-minded and learnt to kind of not say no. So there's an element of that. There's also an element of it all being so, you know, all these things were run on a shoestring. So suddenly when there's money about, very few of them were limited companies, very few of them owned their properties, owned their offices. Very few of them had any real responsibility other than signing bands and having fun, you know. And once everyone knows what happens, hedonism happens when there's success.
Has the ease with which anyone can produce and distribute music nowadays, thanks to the web, done for the concept of those indie entrepreneurs of the past? After all, you don't need that drive and determination to put out records now, do you? You just need a good web connection.
That's true.
Broadband.
I think the internet's a much better tool for, and a resource for bands. I say this with a slightly heavy heart, but I think the independent labels of today are sort of curators and people who can kind of put things together, which are kind of a nice mix of music, conversation, debate, and all the rest of it. And I think we live in a kind of curated world now, and I'd say that the role of the record label, particularly iconic labels like 4AD and Factory, has slightly been eclipsed by the kind of curatorial sense that we're culture is undergoing at the moment.
The one person I think of from the 80s independent scene who I think probably would have thrived today, although he was outdated at the time, I think, is Mike Alway of Cherry Red and L, with his extremely peculiar approach to music, yes. Which was when he and Jeff Travis were in business running Blanco y Negro. I mean, you talk about this in your book, how Jeff Travis would go out to watch bands to see who should be signed, whereas Mike Alway would sit at home watching The Avengers, thinking he'll get the idea for the record he wants to make from watching TV. And the same when he set up L Records subsequently, yeah. Putting together manufactured indie groups to sing songs about curry.
Do you like it hot? Well, so do I. If I don't get some, I'll surely die. It's me like it hot. From the corner shop, you're open on Sundays, Raj was Mondays, Tando Tuesday, Pops on Wednesday, half day Thursday, then it's Friday. I can't wait to have something hot.
And he would have been the ideal person for this curatorial world, wouldn't he?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can really imagine Florence and the Machine being on L, you know, with no budget. So I'm going to get this sort of slightly well-to-do English girl with a great voice and dress her up as a woodland fairy. And, you know, she's going to sing quasi-sexual songs about her identity or something, you know, that's just L written all over it, but she's on Universal.
Yes, the difference would have been if Mike Alway had signed her, she would have sold about 25 copies.
Yes, exactly.
Which would now be hugely collectible.
Exactly. But no, Mike's a wonderful man. He had a huge influence in Japan, enormous influence on people like Cornelius and Pizzicato 5, who are probably the most successful in the L lineage, if you can call it that. But Mike's ideas for L. In the book, he talks about the need to have coffee, and there was no good coffee where he lived, and he tried to sign Keith Floyd to L. So he'd have, you know, he was ahead of branding, he was ahead of the celebrity chef movement, he was ahead of cross-pollination of everything, you know, he was a man ahead of his time. But sadly, I think the one thing that happened with L was John Peel never played him, so it never quite connected. But he's a wonderful raconteur, Mike, and yes, I thought it was important to give him his due.
It is the amazing thing, isn't it, actually, that in the 1980s, being played on John Peel was completely the difference between your label or your band being successful and your label or your band being ignored.
Yes, it was. Within the economics and independent sector, it was the NME front cover being played on John Peel.
But are independent labels, do you think, in a position now where actually they're once again able to perhaps get the artistic pick in a way that they haven't been for a few years? I did a piece the other week about the Nashville Garage yeah. Rock Underground, and one of the producers there who's recorded tons of these bands is saying, well, you know, the major labels are around, but I just don't see any point in any of these bands signing to a major label now,
yeah.
Because what are you going to get from a major except an unrecoupable advance? There is nothing else in this day and age
sure.
they can offer you apart from the advance.
Well, I think there'd never been many number one albums in America. So once Arcade Fire, who on Merge in America, got the upper echelons of the American chart, it was proven that an independent could get to the top of the charts. And also, I think it's interesting, once Rough Trade was revitalised at the turn of the century, Jeff didn't manage to sign the White Stripes, but they signed an independent, they signed to XL. But the White Stripes, the Strokes, the Libertines, all those bands wanted to be with Rough Trade. And then what happened then was Franz Ferdinand, Arctic Monkeys signed with Domino. Then you had a lot of other bands signing to independent labels like Maximo Park on Warp. Block Party were a very successful band on Wichita for a while. So suddenly you had guitar music with independent labels for the first time since the mid-'80s, late-'80s, really. And they all sold very well. So I think, you know, Daniel Miller never signed contracts. He wanted 50-50 deals. He was Depeche Mode's record producer and record label boss. And, you know, he got them international number ones on a handshake deal, split the profits 50-50. And when I spoke to him, he just said, what is a record company, what chance does a record company have of succeeding if they're not into cooperation? So I think that's where independents are likely to thrive these days, is, as you say, rather than just give a wadge of money and put someone into a system, they can say, you know, what can we do? What can we get out of this together? And I think those ideas of sort of cooperation and being in on something together, a label and a band, will prove very seductive.
That was Richard King talking to Michael Hann. How Soon Is Now? The Mad Men and Mavericks Who Made Independent Music is published by Faber and Faber. I recommend you get it, actually. It's
I'm really excited to read it.
It's got some amazing stuff in it, including the story of why a fairly obscure band called Spireer X were the only band signed to 4AD who didn't get their sleeve done by the in-house 4AD design company 23 Envelope, which sounds like quite a boring thing, but is one of the greatest stories I have ever heard in my entire life. The conclusion of which, I'm not going to spoil it, but the conclusion of which is so mind-blowing it's an image that will stay with you for the rest of your lives. That's all I'm going to say about it.
That's good, because I was going to say, you know, I don't know how they're going to rival the Pat Long Enemy Balls Out stories, but yeah. Hopefully.
Testicles are involved.
Aha! Uh-huh,
I'll give you another clue. Testicles are involved. Excellent, yeah. That's what I always look for.
Definition of a good story.
Definition of a good story. Any testicles in it? That's it for this week. Thank you very much to Laura for joining us. Let us know your thoughts at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. We'll be back in a week's time, but until then, thanks for listening.
During April, The Guardian's podcasts are partnering with audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/audible to find out more.